My name is Mark Suchman. I'm the new executive director at the American Bar Foundation. And I started in September. This has been a whole, however many months it is, of firsts for me. And so this is my first chance to introduce an ABF CLE session. So I'm thrilled to be here. And of course, I'm also thrilled to introduce our moderator for today's CLE panel, Laura Farber. Laura serves as the national chair of the ABF Fellows, and she's also a current patron fellow. She's a partner in the Pasadena, California law firm of Hahn & Hahn, and is an accomplished trial lawyer in the areas of employment and commercial litigation and personal injury. She's a longtime leader in the ABA. She currently serves as the chair of the House of Delegates Committee on Rules and Calendar, which anybody who studies committees on rules knows is where the power lies. She's also the recipient of numerous awards, including the ABA Spirit of Excellence Award. She was named the 2022 National Latina Woman of the Year by the Mexican American Opportunity Foundation. And she is also a past president of the Tournament of Roses and chair of the Rose Bowl Management Committee. So we're thrilled to have her leadership on the ABF board and grateful to her for moderating today's event. And in honor of the Rose Bowl, I will now hand it off to her to kick off the session.
Love that, Mark. Thank you so much. So nice to see everybody, and very happy to be here for this incredible panel, and I know you will enjoy this tremendously. What I want to do right now is I want to introduce our esteemed panelists, and we're going to start with Sherry Seidman-Diamond, who is a research professor at the American Bar Foundation and the Howard J. Trinans Professor of Law at Northwestern University Pritzker Law School. With a background in law and social psychology, she is a leading expert in empirical research on jury processes and legal decision making. Diamond has authored over 150 publications in law reviews and behavioral science journals, including the forthcoming reference guide on survey research in the Reference Manual on Scientific Evidence. A former practitioner at Sidley Austin, she has taught at prestigious institutions such as the University of Chicago and Harvard University. Diamond's contributions extend beyond academia. She served as the editor of the Law and Society Review and was president of the American Psychology Law Society. She has been an expert witness in American and Canadian courts, focusing on juries, trademarks, and deceptive advertising. Notably, her work has been cited by federal and state courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Diamond received the 2010 Harry J. Calvin Jr. Award and the 1991 American Psychological Association Award for Distinguished Contributions to Research in Public Policy. Elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2012, she continues to play a vital role in shaping legal practices as a special advisor to the ABA Jury Commission and a member of the Second Circuit Committee on Pattern Criminal Jury Instructions. We are thrilled to have Sherry Diamond with us. Next to Sherry, Judge Brian Edwards currently serves as judge of the Jefferson County Circuit Court's 11th Division. He previously served as chief circuit judge for Jefferson County Metro Region and has served as a Jefferson County Circuit Judge since 2009. He is the recipient of the Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers Fair Administration of Justice Award, the American Board of Trial Advocates Trial Judge of the Year Award, the University of Kentucky College of Law Distinguished Jurist Award, the Kentucky Bar Association's Distinguished Judge Award, and the Kentucky Justice Association's Trial Judge of the Year Award. Incredible. Prior to joining the bench, Judge Edwards practiced law for 13 years, receiving the Louisville Bar Association's Frank Haddad Outstanding Young Lawyer Award in 2004. He also taught at the University of Louisville in both the College of Arts and Sciences and the Brandeis School of Law. Judge Edwards attended Northwestern University, graduating with honors in 1992 before attending and graduating from the University of Kentucky College of Law in 1996. He currently serves on the board of directors for the Peet Foundation and also serves as the founding director of the West Louisville Soccer Initiative. We're thrilled to have Judge Edwards with us. And last but definitely not least is Gregory J. Bubalow. He's known nationally for his relentless pursuit of justice. As owner and managing partner of Bubalow Law PLC and Becker Law Office, he handles cases that involve all aspects of personal injury, including the following: motorcycle, motor vehicle, and trucking accidents, medical malpractice and nursing home abuse, premises liability, drug product and medical device litigation, wrongful death, and mass tort lawsuits. Board certified in trial and pretrial advocacy since 2002, he's a recognized attorney listed in the Best Lawyers in America and named a super lawyer for over 15 years, awarded Best Lawyer in Louisville in 2020, 2022, and 2024. He boasts a rich career. Initially representing doctors in medical malpractice, Greg transitioned to plaintiff's law in 1999, achieving a $17 million verdict in Loomis versus St. Mary's Hospital. Specializing in mass tort actions, he secured a $3 million award in Stribling versus Wyeth and a $5.8 million judgment in Margaret Frazier et al. Versus Wyeth. Greg's firm has recovered over $100 million in products liability, drug, and device cases since 2016. Admitted to practice in Kentucky, Indiana, and various federal courts, Greg's impact on the legal landscape is undeniable. Please welcome our esteemed panelists. Now, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Sherry Diamond, who is going to start with the research part of this presentation, and you will be fascinated by the findings. Sherry?
Thanks, Laura and Mark, and thanks to my fellow panelists. We've had a lively discussion in advance of this session, so I know you're going to enjoy their comments at the end of when I speak. They are very talented and knowledgeable. But I thought I'd start by thanking all of you because, of course, the research I'll be talking about today has only been possible because of your support. All of my research that I'll be talking about today, including the major topic of science and law, could not have taken place without the support of the American Bar Foundation. It really is a very special organization, and it's always worth taking a moment and saying how much the academic types who do our work there appreciate having the opportunity and support of it. And every time I give a talk to a group associated with the Bar Foundation, I learn something because the interplay between all of you and all of us is also special indeed. So this is a talk about experts in court, the challenges for science and law, and it began as a project in a sort of an odd way, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But I thought I would start with an acknowledgement of just how important science and law and their interchange are today. That is, when we look at the legal system, it is permeated with science and engineering. It began many, many years ago with physicians being called upon to indicate how long a pregnancy was, but it has taken many, many forms in the current life that we all lead now. So these are just some examples of chemistry and biology and epidemiology used in determining the effects of chemical exposure. Statistical evidence, for those of you who have association with labor law, statistical evidence is a standard form of expert evidence in employment discrimination cases. Engineering expertise takes a key role when there has been a construction accident, so determining the cause of a bridge collapse. And on the criminal side, we see it in the form of DNA and toxicology expertise as well. Those are just some examples. Now, it's not just in federal and high-profile cases that we see the central role of expert testimony. Another project that you all funded was the Arizona Jury Project, in which we looked at 50 civil cases in a state court, and they ranged from motor vehicle to medical malpractice. And 84% of those cases had expert testimony. And 77% of the experts faced opposing experts. In the surveys I'll talk about today, you'll find similar numbers, high incidence of expert testimony. And what the jury project told us is that the role of the experts in these cases is not just window dressing. So just to give you some instances why that I say that's true, we were able to look at actual jury deliberations. So we know when they talked about or didn't talk about the experts. And it turns out that 89% of the experts were talked about during jury deliberations. And those that weren't talked about were usually damages experts in a case that never went to damages, that ended in liability. So they weren't really relevant for the jurors in deciding. They talk primarily about the substantive content of the testimony, not about the clothing or the appearance or whatever, peripheral things, but about the content. And in that jurisdiction, it was Arizona, in that jurisdiction, jurors were permitted to submit questions for witnesses, and jurors asked questions of nearly half of all of the expert witnesses. So the jurors were paying attention to the content of the expert testimony. So we have an important set of people, and the question is, what challenges are presented to the jury system in dealing with experts? So there are three, I would say. One is identifying competent scientific and engineering experts, finding the right people, recruiting them to participate, and third, using their expertise well in the system. These are all, it turns out, fairly large challenges. Now, there are some problems associated with the relationship between science and law, and I just thought I would give you an overview, a highlight of what they are, or at least the way people talk about them. And it's the culture and language of the two areas that sometimes cause some difficulty. On science, you would say on the scientific side, they talk in probabilistic terms, right? That's the way scientists speak. I speak that way when I have my science hat on, right? But the law doesn't want that. The law has to choose between alternatives. And so there's an equivocation there that's different on the law and science side. And in science, any scientist will tell you that we're constantly in development. Things are changing. Decisions are tentative. But on the law side, there's a need for closure, at least in that current case. So there are these challenges for dealing with them. Now, the claim was made, this was in 2001, but people still make this claim, that scientists tend to be leery of lawyers and the legal process, and they prefer not to venture into the courtroom, right? So we started out with the question, to what extent is that claim correct, right? Are there any reasons for that reluctance, and what can be done about it? So we began with a sample of members of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the scientists and engineers who were part of that elite elected academy. And we asked them to their impressions of the legal system, their experience with the legal system, and what kinds of changes might be made to make the legal system easier for them. But that was a small and elite sample, and we learned a lot from it, but we recognized that we needed to have a broader sample of scientists and engineers who would not necessarily be among the most distinguished, but who had expertise and could be regularly serving in courtroom proceedings. And then we thought, you know, these are sort of more academic types, right? But there are a whole group of folks who spend a lot of their time consulting. And so we tried to get a sample of those folks. That was hard to do, I can tell you, and that's another story for how that came out. But we do have a third group that I'll talk about. We call those the professionals. And the fourth group, the fourth survey was of attorneys, because, of course, how attorneys respond to experts is an important part of the story and their experience with them in the legal system. So this just tells you a little bit about the differences among the three expert samples. So you can see that on the left is the Academy sample, the middle one is the American Association of Arts and Sciences. These are people who subscribe to Science Magazine, are interested in science, but are not elected members of the of that group. And then there's the professional group. And you can see that the mean number of folks who are from the academy, their mean number of times having assisted in the legal system was 12.8. These are all people who did assist. For the AAAS, the mean number was 19. And for the professionals, it was almost 325. The median, that is, the point at which half the people were higher and half the people were lower, was 3 for each of the first two samples and 95 for the professionals. The most common amount of experience for the academy and the association was 1. For the professionals, it was 50. And you can see at the bottom the difference in terms of how much their earning came from consulting activities. We didn't ask for the academy, but it was 1.4%, had 50% or more for the AAAS, and 68.2%, 50% or more for the third sample. So these are different sources of information on the relationship between science and law from three different perspectives. Now, the first question, are scientists being asked for assistance? I actually thought when we started this project that the problem was that really good scientists weren't being approached and they were frequently just left out of the loop that way. It turned out I was wrong. That more than half of the members of the academy who were scientists and engineers had at some point been asked, more than a third of those in the AAAS. And amongst those asked, it wasn't that they were saying no. It turns out that when they were asked, they were very likely to say yes. So we have 72%, actually it's 90% for the academy. It's just that some of the cases didn't end up leading to court. So even though they said yes, they didn't participate. And the similarly high number for those in the AAAS. So if they're being asked, and they're being willing to participate, then the question is, well, when don't they participate? And so we asked them to think back to all the times that they had turned down requests to serve as an expert. Now, what were the most common reasons? And this first slide shows you the most common reasons they had for not participating. And what I want, it's not surprising that time and other commitments was a big factor. We're all busy people, and they are busy people too. But the one I want to point out to you of really being important is that they were being requested for help outside their area of expertise. So nearly half of the academy and for over 40% of the AAAS folks said that. It's great that a quarter of them said they didn't participate because the evidence didn't favor their side. We would hope that would happen, right? They didn't particularly want to work for parties or attorneys. Well, they're entitled to do that. They're entitled to say that. And then there's this one-fifth who have some doubts about the legal system, which I'll get back to later. But you say, well, outside of my area of expertise, but what about the professionals? And it turns out that the professionals, too, reported a high rate of being asked to offer assistance outside their area of expertise. So that's a problem because it means that somehow our sorting system isn't working very well. So then we looked at what the attorney said about how they selected experts. And these were all experienced trial attorneys in an elite organization. And here was their answer. We said, you know, which sources do you generally use? And if you look at the bottom of this table, you can see that only 3 in 10 used an expert referral organization. So it doesn't appear that the new expert referral organizations are fixing this problem of mismatch, perhaps because they're not being used as much, perhaps for other reasons. Okay. Things that didn't account for a turning down a request for assistance. Well, we did find that the professionals sometimes had conflicts of interest, but notice the last two, that advisor or institutional policy against it was a very low response, and fee issues were a low response. So these are not the things that were interfering with a willingness to accept assignments within the legal system. Now, let's take a look at how they experience the legal system. This table, this figure shows you how people who testified, were deposed, or wrote reports responded to that experience. And there are a couple of things to point out here. First, overall, the green bars, let's see if I can get this to help me. Oh, yeah. It's not showing up on here. Okay, the green bars are the professionals, and they're always more enthusiastic, right? They like their job. That's nice. And the Academy folks and the AAAS folks were all above the mean in terms of their ratings, above 50% in terms of their ratings of the overall experience. So the people who participate actually do seem to enjoy the experience. But here's the most interesting thing, I think, on this, and that is, look at the middle bar, the reddish-orange bar, and that is being deposed, right? So what do you like best as an expert? Oh, well, writing a report is the best thing. complete control, right? Testifying is pretty good. That's great. Being deposed, not so much. I thought maybe it was because it's basically cross-examination, and there's no judge there, at least keeping things in line. But we asked about whether not having a judge present during depositions was a problem, and they didn't see that as a problem. So I think it's basically cross-examination. I think that's what's going on with the deposition response. Okay. We also asked participants what they saw as threats to the ability of the court to reach sound scientific conclusions. And we had a whole series of things that they could respond to. I'm just highlighting a couple of them. The first two that you can see there where a majority expressed some concern about this feature were the you can always find an expert for hire who will say anything in return for a fee. And these are the experts talking. And the adversary system encourage experts to slant their testimony in favor of the party employing them. A significant, but not a majority, also were uncomfortable with the fact that experts perceive their experts as not attorneys up here, right? Yeah, pushed their experts to express more certainty than is warranted. Okay, so now we say, well, what kinds of changes might be made in the legal system that we might have some improvement? And we asked about four different things. We asked about court-appointed experts. We asked about having opposing experts get together and write a joint report. Maybe not realistic. Allowing opposing experts to question each other in open court, which in fact is done a bit in, it's called hot tubbing in Australia. And finally, allowing jurors to submit questions to the judge for the experts to answer. And as you can see, professionals were somewhat less enthusiastic about each of these changes than the AAAS members. But what I think is interesting is that both groups gave lower ratings for allowing the experts to question one another. They don't really want to be lawyers. That's the lawyer's job. That's just fine. But they do want to be teachers. So allowing jurors to submit questions to the judge, they're very enthusiastic about that. They want to be conveying to the decision maker what they're doing. Okay, what did the lawyers say in response to these questions? Well, here, the first column is the two expert samples, and the final column is the attorneys. I don't think you'll find this surprising. What it says is that these kinds of changes, it's a loss of control for attorneys if there are court-appointed experts and they don't select their own experts. But what I think is really interesting here is the last one, because this has seen a change over time. Allowing jurors to submit questions for the experts was perceived very negatively by attorneys 10 or 15 years ago. And over time, as this has been done in a number of courts, there has been an increase in support for that use. So there is a change that's come about, and it's only at 63%. I predict that it will grow higher as time goes on. So what? Some good news about this current situation. I told you some worrisome news. We asked In litigation or arbitration where science and engineering issues are involved, how successful do you think the legal system is in handling it? And here are our four samples. Quite positive. But I am going to close with another finding that I hope you will find intriguing, which is that there is a difference in the rating of how successful the legal system is between those who have participated and those who haven't. So it goes from 53%, 54% to 70% in the academy between non-participators and participators, from 57 to 66% similarly in the AAAS group. So participation is associated with a more positive feeling. Now, of course, there's a question about causality here. Do the people who are willing to participate start out feeling better, or is it an effect of participation? We have a little control group sort of that comes from people who agreed to participate, but the case fell apart and they didn't end up actually participating, and they look more like the non-participants. So that's one little piece of evidence. So finally, willingness to do in the future. You know, if you've participated, you're more likely to be enthusiastic about participating again. Another piece of evidence in that direction. Final slide. The challenges and future opportunities. I think there are three. You know, Laura talked about takeaways. This is important takeaways, right? One is facilitating identification of competent experts with relevant expertise. This is the matching problem I talked about. And I think not just directories, but the kind of organization that I think that Greg is going to talk about, where there's a serious work on matching experts and attorneys who need them. Second, providing experience with the legal system for scientists and engineers, or at least more experience with lawyers, because they do feel more kindly when they've had more experience. The ABA has a joint committee of scientists and lawyers with the AAAS, and it's mostly focused, my understanding is, on educating judges about science. But in some ways, I think they could do a really good job by focusing also on educating scientists about the legal system, and we haven't focused on that before. And finally, there's possibly some modifying of legal procedures to make better use of experts, some of the things we talked about. So thank you very much, and now we will, Laura is in charge of seeing the next steps.
Well, what I want to do is I want to ask our other panelists a few questions. I'm going to start with Judge Edwards. What has been, in your view, the most effective use of experts in your courtroom? First question.
Thank you, Laura. Welcome to everybody here. I believe I see experts in two contexts. I'll talk first about in the criminal cases that we have. My court handles felony criminal cases all the way up to death penalty cases. And I've seen criminal defense attorneys do a wonderful job of presenting expert testimony in capital cases, in areas both in the guilt phase, where they bring in experts, DNA experts to combat and counter the experts that the prosecution has presented. I've seen that that can be very effective. I think there's a tendency a lot of times for folks just to concede on DNA, and I don't think that's a good thing. I think there are opportunities and times where that needs to be challenged and it can be done effectively. And then if there's a finding of guilt and it gets to a sentencing phase, I think it's essential, particularly in a capital case, that you bring in a mitigation expert. Experts who can come in and talk about the individual defendant's life, the life history, the experiences that he or she may have had that may have led them to the spot that they have found themselves in before the court, and that can give the jury an opportunity to find reasons to mitigate when they are adjudicating the sentence and fixing the sentence. In the civil context, and we talked about this a bit on the call, I think I really do think that less is more. I think that experts are important, but I think that there can be overkill. And I think that juries, when I talk to my juries after cases, their attention spans aren't great. Primacy and recency is a real thing, that concept. They remember the things that come out at the beginning, they remember the things that come out at the end, and some of the stuff in the middle, if it's a 4, 5, 6 week trial, it gets lost upon them. So I think getting in there, hidden with your best, most charismatic, but thorough expert early, if you're a plaintiff's attorney, and closing with that, if you're a defense attorney, I think that can be very effective.
Thank you. Greg. How do you find your experts in your incredible practice? I want to know.
Well, I start out kind of shocked at the mismatching issue because, you know, it seems to me that I need to know as much about my subject as the expert does in order to not sound like an idiot, although I might be sounding like an idiot to you right now. So, and if I start out with a subject, I'll just use Cauda Aquinas syndrome. It's a medical emergency in an emergency room. I will read all the articles on the standard of care on Cauda Aquinas syndrome, and then my ideal expert will be an emergency room doctor who has written what an emergency room physician should do when confronted with that issue. And so the ideal would be, wouldn't it, the expert who has a journal article writing about the standard of care of emergency room physicians in the situation which I have a client. So I don't know how the mismatch occurs with very competent attorneys. I have to say, you know, venture into that because those attorneys should understand what experts they need to prove their case and which ones would be most qualified. The other thing I do to try to mitigate any mismatch is use expert search firms, but very particular ones, because I'm not looking for professional experts. I'm looking for people who really don't make their living, testifying in court. And it seems to me that one agency in general, I don't want to become their commercial, they have people on staff who are experts themselves looking for the expert. And so I find that my rate of matching with experts are actually higher than when I ask for dates. When I would have a date, a little bit higher with the experts than the rejection for a date. So if you're an expert asking the expert to communicate, then there's a greater comfort. And so I might say to this agency who has, for instance, surgeons on staff, what have you, I love this expert, but I don't want to approach them because I'm afraid that they have a misconception about what I may be or what I'm asking for. Then finally, I also have an expert contract. And in the contract, one of the first things I point out to the expert is we are not asking you to be advocates. We're asking you to testify to what you believe the truth is. I'm the advocate. And so I make them sign a contract that that's what they're going to do. And I assure them that I'm not going to push them to areas that are uncomfortable for them. I'm going to push them to find the truth. And that's the type of expert you want, right? I mean, someone who believes in your cause because it is the truth. So I think all of those points, those three points, hit on what Sherry was saying about the reluctance of people basically being experts, the problem of mismatch, and also the experience with the legal system. Because when the lawyer is saying, just give me the truth and nothing but the truth, they're much more comfortable.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. I have a case right now where I'm stuck with my treating physicians. You don't choose them. It's not a retained expert, right? Retained experts is one thing. Treating physicians is another. We had to get our trial continued twice because of their schedules, because they're working as physicians. And so we've now had to record our testimony by video so that we can actually have the testimony and not cause a third continuance of our trial. So do any of you have any thoughts about retained, how to use retained versus not retained, but you're stuck with experts? What have you done in terms of distinguishing, if any, how you manage those? And I don't know, Sherry, if your research touched on any of that. So I'm interested in the distinction, if any, that came out in your research, but also if you, Judge Edwards or Greg, or if you've seen anything different in terms of the retained versus the people you're stuck with them. I don't mean to say they're not great. Some of them are, some of them I won't comment. But anyway, your thoughts.
So not on this study so much, but on our study of juror reactions to the experts, there's a kind of plus minus situation with the kind of expert you're talking about, the hybrid expert who is the treating physician, because the form that I've seen, you tell me if you think this is typical, is that the treating physician is the plaintiff's expert, and the defense, usually hired by an insurance company, gives an evaluation, but from the jury's point of view, they have different advantages. The treating physician knows the plaintiff well, has spent a lot of time with the plaintiff. The defense, who is always phrased as, I hate this phrase, the independent medical expert, as if they're not hired by the defense, right? And they say, and they have maybe seen only records or not seen the plaintiff at all. And so the jury says, well, he only had this. But on the other hand, he's objective. So there are plus minuses in it. And then it distills down to the quality of the testimony by that particular expert.
I don't have that supporting this. This is
you have experience.
I've got experience. It's anecdotal. But, I think that I agree. I think that jurors, they gravitate and they do give some perhaps extra credence to the testimony of treating physicians simply because they actually saw the plaintiff or whoever the party pursuing the claim is. They actually saw them as opposed to the experts that were retained who reviewed the treating physician's records and the other records, the medical records in the case. I think intuitively jurors, maybe I'm projecting on jurors my own thoughts, but I think intuitively I give a little bit more credence to the doctor, the person who was hands-on and actually saw and treated in these cases. As far as, and I think the question touched a little bit on this, concerns, and we're seeing more of it now, particularly post-COVID, with witness testimony being presented remotely or from previously recorded trial deposition testimony. I have found that jurors, and we always give an admonition to our juries to give the same weight that they would give if the person was there in person, live in trial. And I think jurors do that for the most part. I see them paying the same amount of attention, or lack thereof, when it's presented via video as they do when the person's there in person. I know everyone prefers having live testimony, I certainly do. But I don't think it's as detrimental as in some way might perceive.
Before we go to Greg, have you seen more remote testimony post-pandemic?
I have. And we've always seen it with the treating physicians because of their schedules. To get a case to trial in a reasonable period of time, a lot of times you have to make those accommodations, but we are seeing more of it.
Could we just make clear a distinction that I think makes a difference? One is whether it's live streaming remote versus a video deposition kind of context where it's pre-recorded. I think those are very different and can be very different, and one way in which they can be very different is that the jurors can't submit questions for the expert if it's a video deposition, and they can if it's live streaming.
And I think they're both better than the, you all may have seen this, the old-fashioned way where someone takes a deposition and they role-play it and they read it. I don't know if you've seen that. That, they do zone out. I don't think that's very effective. I think that some sort of video presentation, preferably the live stream, I agree, definitely beats that.
Well, I think with a treating physician, and that's only one type of expert. It completely depends on the case, which is a kind of an obvious thing. If you are a plaintiff in a malpractice case, you're going to find that treating physicians are not so friendly to you, even if they're on your side, essentially from the facts. A treating physician is supposed to be testifying to what's in his medical records. He's not supposed to have an opinion on secondary forces or sources, I should say. And so you should know what the treating physician is going to say before you walk in to the deposition. Now, in our practice, which is not the practice in other places, we can't actually subpoena physicians and other people in Kentucky to be at trial. Other states, unless, of course, Judge Edwards orders it, and then they will come. But the fact is that most of our treating physicians are going to be testifying by tape. But having said that, if they have an opinion that makes a difference for you, it's powerful testimony, and it's great if you have it, it's great if you don't have it. For instance, I remember, and this really dates me back in FinFin, all the pulmonologists were on our side because they hated fenfluramine and they hated the disease that that drug caused their patients. And so I felt like royalty coming into a treating physician's office because they hated that drug so much. On the other hand, I can't even talk to doctors in Kentucky. Most of them basically, even if they treated my client, are working for hospitals. And so if I ask Baptist Health or any local hospital, they will just refuse me access, which is, I think, somewhat outrageous, but that's the case. So, you know, you're kind of throwing the dice when you go in to depose the non-retained expert who is testifying supposedly to his medical records. You're holding your breath and hoping that some other opinions won't come out because of the nature of the case. It's very difficult.
Sherry, in your research, have you found anything about this perception versus experience is fascinating. you know, in terms of people that haven't participated in the system and what their perception is. What do you attribute to be the reason for that gap? Is it just because they haven't had the opportunity, or because they're afraid, or that this whole cross-examination thing? You know, you're going to get it in a deposition, but you're still going to get it in court. And so I'm fascinated too by that dichotomy, the difference between depositions and trial. Could you elaborate on any of that?
Well, so two things. One, the difference between deposition and trial. I mean, in a deposition, you don't get to do direct. So you don't get to tell your story. And so I think that there is a difference there in terms of the experience. I mean, one of the complaints in the open-ended, you know, responses that we saw were complaints about the legal system because it didn't allow me to tell my everything I wanted to say about the topic. You know, I'm an expert on the topic, and they're asking me these very narrow questions, which, of course, as lawyers, we all know, those are the, you know, there's a reason for that. But from the expert's point of view, that can be quite frustrating. I think when we look at the lack of experience and what it does and where images come from, we don't have to look any further than media and news and fiction and stories, which inform, surprisingly, everybody, right? Or maybe not surprisingly, everybody. So the views that people have of either the way juries work, or the way lawyers behave, or the way experts behave, I think can be quite misinformed. Some of it's misinformation about things that are idealistic, and some of it is not. So, for example, you all know 12 Angry Men. And that's a lovely film, but it is not super accurate in terms of describing what goes on in the jury room. But that film has been made in various versions in 6 different countries, their own version of it, and has huge following that is sweet but not accurate. So I think these images are also, scientists are victims of those as well when it comes to judging what the legal system does to science.
Judge Edwards, when do you decide that you need to utilize a court-appointed expert, and how does it work in Kentucky?
I can't think of a time that I've utilized a court-appointed expert in a civil case. Nature of cases that come before me. The closest that we come would typically be in criminal cases. We were talking earlier, I had a case this morning in which the defense attorney raised an issue with the court concerned about the competency of her client to stand trial. And so she filed a motion asking that we appoint an expert to come evaluate her client to issue a report determining whether or not he was competent. So we see that relatively frequently. That's one example, and we rely upon those experts all the time. Here in Kentucky, those experts, we don't have a panel or anything of that sort. We simply sign the order. We send the order to our state psychiatric facility, and they have doctors on staff that are then assigned to perform those evaluations and given reports. We do at times sign orders. If an individual's been deemed indigent, they can file a motion pursuant to call it Chapter 31, and that's our legislative provision that created our public defender system here in Kentucky. And under that chapter, we can appoint, or we can give funds. We can authorize the payment of funds to a public defender to go out and retain their own expert. That happens frequently. Again, going back to the capital case example I talked about earlier, we see that all the time there. But it may happen in a case involving a fatal car accident that has criminal charges attached to it. They may get an accident reconstructionist DNA experts, things of that sort. But it's not the court-appointed expert in the context that I think maybe was looked at in the study.
So court-appointed experts are frequently talked about, but are not used a great deal. The federal system, as you probably know, allows for it, but judges are reluctant to do it because it means requiring the parties to pay for an expert that they don't haven't hired or selected. Judges were lawyers before they were judges, and they are seem to be a little reluctant to get into that business.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised too that more court-appointed experts aren't used. I've had just, you know, I've practiced too long to mention without embarrassment, but I've had only a couple of experiences with court-appointed experts, most recently in Lexington. And it turned out great for us because the judge said, okay, both sides, put up your best, and I'm going to select maybe one of your suggestions, or I'm going to go out, and this was, by the way, on a discovery issue, a computer issue, electronically stored information, and I might go outside of the selections that both of you make. And so the judge happened to pick our expert, who was very well qualified, and it was a great experience for us. But I, you know, we did not vet that expert. We didn't, you know, talk to the expert ahead of time. We just said, this guy knows what he's doing. We think we're right, and he's going to support us, and he did. It seems to me that's a great way, especially to now that we have such trouble as lawyers. You know, I need the tech guy right next to me all the time, right? I kind of know what metadata is, but it's become central to our practice to understand computers. There are no documents anymore. So especially in that circumstance, to have someone who really a forensic computer expert or something to point at, it's shocking to me that the court doesn't do that more often. But I understand it. It's not what is the custom.
Yeah, how, I'm curious. I've had experience where I've talked to a prospective expert. I might have called this person, and it might have been a lawyer referral, or, you know, whatever the source is, and I'm thinking, I don't know how effective this person's going to be in front of the jury. And I mean, I know it's hard to evaluate with a phone call, but how they speak, are they going to teach? Is the jury going to pay attention? Are they going to be engaged? Are they going to be persuasive? How do you do that, Greg? How do you make those, how do you analyze that and do the best you can to ensure you're getting the best person, both expertise, but also that relationship and the communication piece?
Yeah, I'm so with you there, because you can have the most qualified person in the world, and if they're boring, forget it. You know, or they're not able to put things in, you know, normal language. What we do is we make a tremendous tremendous effort to search. We may talk to two or three experts in the field, and now we use Zoom, okay? Because you can't really see, you know, how that person is going to be unless you have them at least on video. And it's kind of a beauty contest, isn't it? You know, interview them on Zoom. Do they have a sense of humor? Do they know what verbal irony is? Things of that sort. And we're able to select people. I have actually one expert, the head of neurology at Case Western, who I am urging all the time to have a cable news network, you know, to explain neurology, because most neurologists I've talked to are like medieval philosophers. You're just not sure what they're saying, but this guy can explain it in in a sense that makes a huge difference. So what you're saying is absolutely right. It's very difficult to get that combination.
And I know we talked about this a little bit and didn't know how relevant it was to the topic, and then we kind of tied it in. Motions in limine, dealing with excluding an expert or narrowing their testimony or somehow managing it before it actually gets to trial. What, if anything, do you see, do you think about the use of them or being on the receiving end of them and how they can also impact the experience? So anyone that wants to start on that.
So I think Judge Edwards had some things to say about that, right?
I certainly encourage them. You don't want to have prepared your trial and have your experts all lined up, and then some mean judge, once you call them, says, no, I'm not going to let them testify. So I think it's certainly good practice to have these motions in limine in advance. We're a Daubert state. We have Daubert hearings all the time in advance of trial. I very much prefer to do it a month ahead of the trial, as opposed to do it the day before the trial and do it during the midst of the trial. We've done it all of those ways before. But I think that I encourage lawyers we'll block out a big chunk of time to take up motions in limine. Frequently there are motions to, again, limit the scope of an expert's testimony or to exclude the expert altogether. And I will endeavor to rule on those. I think it's a practical matter. Sometimes my ruling on those cases, I've seen them settle cases before, and they can change the entire battle, the scope of how that case is going to play out. So, and it's fair to everyone. If I were a practitioner, I want to know, what am I going to be allowed to get into and what's the jury going to be allowed to hear. So I strongly encourage folks making those motions in limine. Hopefully the judges can get those decisions out so you know what you're looking at.
And from the expert's point of view, an expert wants to know in advance what they're going to be permitted to talk about, and a good expert is going to feel much more comfortable with limitations on what they can talk about rather than having the possibility that they're going to be asked about things that they really aren't in a position to answer. So what I said about some of the data from the project showing that experts are sometimes frustrated that they can't completely explain, that doesn't mean that they want to be talking about topics that they, that go beyond their expertise. So those boundaries are helpful for the attorney, and I think also for the experts.
Well, they scare me to death. I don't know whether the problem with that from a plaintiff's practice, of course, is you might invest, especially in products liability and mass torts, hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million, in experts, and so to then prepare these well-qualified experts and then have and especially in federal court, a judge tell you, sorry, all that investment's down the drain because that guy's not testifying. That might end the case there, period, especially on issues of causation, but it might not be totally fair. Some judges are just wrong about letting that kind of testimony in. So that type of investment scares a plaintiff's lawyer. That's why I invest so much time trying to get the right expert to match the expertise that I'm going to need to convince that judge.
And I wonder if you would just have to take a writ or something at that time or just appeal it afterwards, because that could really impact, if you had to try the case, could severely limit your effectiveness.
Well, again, I'm going to date myself. When I was in the Vioxx litigation and had hundreds of clients who had heart attacks taking that drug, one of the issues would be for my cardiologist, who might be well qualified, is Vioxx a substantial factor, and a lot of them at first thinking about that, all right? First of all, they don't understand the word substantial factor, all right? And they don't understand that it doesn't have to be the cause, it can be a cause that is a substantial factor. So many of the cardiologists on first spin with us would say, hey, these people are train wrecks. Of course they had a heart attack. Why would you think they would have a heart attack? They've smoked, or they are overweight, or they have problems with cholesterol. And then explaining that it doesn't have to be the cause, it can be a cause that is a substantial factor in that backdrop, makes all the difference in the world. So again, it's the language you use in the law that Sherry was talking about, the difference between that language and what they, as cardiologists, use every day, made all the difference in the world.
Greg, I want you to share a little more. I mean, you touched on this agreement you have with your experts. I want you to tell the audience a little bit more about that, because that was fascinating, the whole thing about probabilistic. Talk, because Sherry's research showed that that's something the experts feel comfortable with, but the legal system and lawyers don't as much. But you're clearly comfortable with that, so explain a little more about that.
Yeah, I really didn't understand that when Sherry, we first talked. And by the way, I love talking to you guys, but, I said, really? I mean, that's what we're supposed to prove. If we don't prove more probable than not, then I'm poured out of the courtroom, right? I'm done. And so the first thing I need to talk to the expert about, especially in a medical issue, is what more probable than not means, what a substantial factor means, and it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. And you have to have an opinion based on the scientific evidence that we know now versus what we could discover later on. So all of that has to be proven by the plaintiff to be successful. And I think it's a matter of communication between the lawyer and the expert many times.
And Sherry, I want to hear your view on that as well, from the research perspective. Having somebody like Greg and having that agreement, what is that? I mean, maybe there's another, again, back to perception. Maybe there's this misperception that the system's different than it is.
Well, I love that agreement. I mean, I asked Greg for a copy of it when he described it, and it's really impressive. And I think it helps create the backdrop for what's being expected from the expert. But I keep wondering, as I listen to Greg, because he's, I mean, really, that's the model, right? In small cases, which do involve experts, I mean, you describe an enormous amount of time and energy that you put in, not only just to understanding what the scientific evidence is that's going to be needed, but in working with your experts. Things that maybe involve less money or are on a quicker time frame, can that be done in the kind of ordinary run-of-the-mill kind of case?
It's tough. I mean, a lot of cases go without experts because there's just not the money to support them. And I think the decisions are not as well informed. So let's face it, money makes the world go around, even in justice.
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate.
This jury asking questions of experts, have either you, Judge Edwards, or Greg, have you ever experienced that? And that's the last question until we turn it over to all of you. So get your questions ready, please, audience. So we're going to allow that in a minute.
I'm glad you asked that question. So when I was practicing, I did most of my trial work was criminal defense work, and there were some judges that allowed that, and I hated it. I I hated it when, you know, I'm like, oh, good, the prosecutor didn't ask that question. Just ask the jury if they have any of the jury asked that question. I'm like, ah. So, you know, so I probably carried that a bit over. And I legitimately think it's problematic in the criminal context. I think that there's burden of proof issues and questions that are asked that when you can't answer them, it kind of answers the question. So in the civil context, I have, I don't invite it, but I've had jurors at times request to do it, and I have allowed it. It's been rare, but you know, after reading Professor Diamond's report, I think I'm going to reconsider it. I mean, hearing that, I think that there can be some merit if you limit it in the context of what types of questions, you know, it's regarding experts and their testimony. I think that there can be some real value to the ultimate goal of, you know, giving the jury all they need to make their determination at the end. So I think I'm going to revisit and have some discussions with some of my colleagues about that.
Great.
Oh, well, I have judges who open the questioning up and some who don't. And I'm really not afraid of it. I'm almost wanting it because I want to know what the jury's thinking, you know. And so when they ask questions, I may find a weakness in my own examination. I think I've thought of all the questions ahead of time. I think I've had the focus groups ahead of our trials that would allow us to understand what normal people think like versus those who've been corrupted by law school. And I think they're great. They're great in the same way that you actually get an answer in voir dire sometime, as opposed to silence and having to always say, I assume by your silence the answer is no, which I hate more than anything else. I want participation, and I want someone to be engaged. And questions will engage people.
Okay. All right. So now it's time for audience participation. Are there any questions? Yes.
There was one area of intersection of law and engineering that was not addressed. I'd like to comment on. I myself have two electrical engineering degrees, I'm a law degree, I'm a patent attorney. And I heard no discussion of patent law or other intellectual property law. If you would do so, please.
Sure, we had a number of experts who were engineers, a fairly large sample of experts who were engineers, and many of them were testified in patent cases, or I can't be sure that they were patent cases, they were intellectual property cases, right? Probably some good percentage of those were patent cases. Their experience turned out not to be different from the experience of PhDs in other areas. I was surprised. That is in global kinds of terms. They were a bit more critical in their open-ended remarks about the quality of education of judges, juries, and lawyers in science and engineering. And I don't know if it is particularly in those cases or if their standards are different from the other, you know, the other experts. So I can't trace it to the cases versus the people on that. But I didn't mention earlier, I'm glad you mentioned this, so it gives me an opportunity to say something. We asked all of our respondents to make suggestions of what they would like to see in changes in the legal system. and a large, we're still coding there, open-ended, long, they responded very, very fully. It was like floodgates. Give me a chance to complain about what could be fixed. But many of their comments were about a lack of education in lay people, in judges, in attorneys. And so science education was really strongly on their agenda. And I think that that subgroup of engineers and folks testifying in patent and IP cases are likely to be heavily represented there because they perceive their work as highly technical and difficult to understand. I mean, maybe there's a reason why we have a patent bar and we don't have a special exam in other areas of the law.
Well, my experience with engineers are mostly in personal injury and in, for instance, most recently airbag cases. And so not in the patent area. If you're talking about causation, mathematics and mechanical engineering is much more predictable, I think, than perhaps medical science. And so when an airbag explodes and sends shrapnel through somebody's face, the cause of that is going to be some sort of defect. And or when a surgical stapler leaves a hole in an anastomosis in an intestinal surgery, that's going to be a problem either with a surgeon or the device, right? And so on the other hand, let's say the standard of care in a med mal case is much more debatable because somebody's standard in X climate is not somebody's standard in the other location. So I just find a variation between the experts.
Hi, I'm Joe Roskowski. I'm a probate judge, and I have a question that goes along like this. Have you experienced any of these third parties buying into litigation and obtaining and paying for expert witnesses at all in your jurisdictions?
I've heard about these things. I've not personally experienced it.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Say that again, Joe. Could you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, there are third-party companies that are buying into litigation and financing litigation, essentially, and paying for the expert witnesses and obtaining them. You haven't experienced any of that?
Yeah, so in mass torts, which I'm involved in, there's a lot of financing because those cases are hugely expensive. And so you will have, for instance, you go to these particular gatherings of mass torts, like Mass Torts Made Perfect or whatever, you'll have actually a finance desk there. And those people then will finance the cases for someone who isn't well capitalized. I never use those, but that is one way to get your expenses paid. And so I'm not sure that it affects the outcome. I'm not sure. Do you have a concern about that?
I guess I'm trying to figure out, are you saying that they are the ones selecting the experts, or are they just paying for the experts? That's what I'm curious.
Well, an attorney that has a case, but maybe short of funds to hire experts, will in fact bring in one of these third-party finances.
Okay. So it's the finance question.
So they put in the cost of representing the plaintiffs, and then they take a percentage of the outcome, which is a high percentage.
Yeah, and right, and it's very common practice. Does it impact justice? I'm not sure it does, but it's a common practice.
Okay.
I don't know, I suspect it does go on. It's not been brought to my attention, and I don't think it, you know, I don't know where it would necessarily, where I would find out about this, you know, when I'm presiding over a case. I don't know who's financing, who's paying.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
Paying the experts in the case, so, but, you know, I suspect that it probably is going on, particularly in those large mass tort cases, cases that borderline on class action.
Yeah, but it would all go through the attorneys. Those companies are giving, have a contract with the attorneys for, as you say, a percentage of the outcome. So they wouldn't have any direct contact with the experts necessarily.
But I would think that they would analyze the case, you know, before determining whether they're going to give the funding, right? Because they're not going to just throw money at something they don't think is going to have value.
Let me say
value.
There's a fee splitting problem. Of course, if you're splitting your fees with non-lawyers, so there are some creative ways around that. And again, I have a regular bank. I just go to the bank. So.
But these companies are mostly run by lawyers, so that it doesn't.
Well, I don't. But they mostly don't have an impact on selecting the
experts.
Right.
Jimmy.
Thank you. This has been a wonderful presentation, and I really enjoyed the presentation by Sherry on the facts, and I've really enjoyed the discussion. This is, I guess, starts with Sherry, but maybe doesn't end there. We see the juxtaposition of either court-appointed experts or the private gladiator experts. But has anyone ever discussed, or has there been any experience with the court-appointed expert where the parties then have a chance to give their responding expert reports if they so choose?
So the way it works, actually, is that if there is a court-appointed expert, that doesn't preclude in any way the parties from having their own experts. And in fact, they usually do have their own experts. One misconception, I think, about court-appointed experts by some of the experts who we surveyed was that, well, that would be great. Then I wouldn't be cross-examined. That's also completely wrong. That is, they, in fact, are subject to cross-examination as a court-appointed expert as well. And then there's one version of the court-appointed expert who then writes the report or gives an opinion, and it turns out it favors one side. That's sort of what Greg was describing, in which case one of the parties adopts that expert. And if it does go to trial, the jury doesn't usually find out that expert was a court-appointed expert. So there are various, many different versions of it, but despite all the talk about it, it tends to be a low, you know, a less likely choice, even in federal court.
This question is perhaps a little more subtle. We've come a long way from 1994 to today talking about these opinion witnesses, and I side with the courts who say that you should not use the word expert to describe as opinion witnesses. But nonetheless, we've come a long way. One of the things, though, that we're still having trouble with is differentiating between scientists and engineers. Engineers, perhaps, in addition to medical doctors, are the most frequently seen opinion witnesses in courtrooms of all engineers of all stripes. And they're not the same, or we wouldn't have this thing called STEM, for example, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. It's not the same. And there have been some very cogent arguments before that engineering is problem solving. Engineering is not the same thing as, and does not depend upon, the scientific method. Now, don't get me wrong, I have slaughtered many an engineering expert on the scientific method. But that's my job. But I am not comfortable with the fact that we need a new set of tools, or perhaps some more nuanced understanding of what engineering is about, as opposed to the origination and the lay judges who decided that in Kumho, oh, it's all the same, right? It's all the same kind of methodology. It's not.
Right.
And very cogent thinkers have said, wait, it's not the same. Are there any prospects for that?
Boy, my crystal ball is a little hazy right now. I think that the extension from Daubert to Kumho has, at least at the Supreme Court level, kind of closed that door, because, as you say, the standards were kind of lumped together, and the federal rules of evidence certainly don't, even in their new version, talking about expert opinion, don't make any kind of a distinction. So I wouldn't be optimistic that there will be anytime soon any kind of a distinction made. I would just say that, first of all, I'm not quite sure what different standards would look like if we said that maybe there should be different standards. So we first have to unpack that. I mean, they both deal in probabilistic evidence. They both deal, you know, there are certain things that there's a great deal of commonality between the two. I think we've gotten when Daubert was first decided, every federal court, and then started with the state courts, would march through the four factors, you know, as if that was all there was, and that was the way you viewed the expert testimony. I think we're getting a little bit better at that, you know, that it's not, Daubert did not say those were the only factors. They said that they were examples. People didn't seem to notice it. It wasn't clear what error rate actually meant. You know, there were all kinds of problems. But I do think that the direction has been better, but my crystal ball says it's not going to happen, at least anytime soon.
Yep, maybe one more question, a final question. Does anyone have one? Okay.
Given a choice, would you prefer to conduct the direct or cross-examination of an expert witness?
Greg?
I think Greg gets that one.
It depends. You know, what do you want me to say? I've really enjoyed cross-examining some experts. But it's difficult, of course, because you can never know as much as the expert. So my mentor was Jack Valentine. Anybody knows him from Kentucky, and he said, "Greg, you as a trial lawyer, you're like a bathtub," which caught my attention immediately. How am I like a bathtub, Jack? And he said, "Because you fill yourself up with knowledge on one particular aspect, which you know nothing about, and then you pull the plug at the end of the trial. And so, and all that drains out. So you have to almost become equal with the expert to cross-examine the expert. And the best ally, of course, is your expert, isn't it? And so both of them have to be married together. And so the answer is, it depends."
I use my expert to help me on cross-ex, because I am not going to win the battle on expertise. And you got to know that going in. So what are the areas that you can challenge, that you can cross-ex on, right? That you know they have to answer it this way, or they're not credible, or it affects, or they're being inconsistent here, or there are things you can point out. You don't have to necessarily accomplish that during the deposition, but it certainly will work at trial. So what are the foundational pieces of it that then can become effective to use at trial, especially if they change and sometimes they do this, change how they answer the question at trial. So I get excited about cross-ex, I'm not gonna lie, but it's scary too, and you just gotta be prepared, I think. So that's my, the experience Greg has had, but that's my sense, whatever it's worth. So, and on that note, we still have a little bit, but I wanted to say one thing. Sherry has been on the ABA Jury Commission as an advisor. You've been advising. And they actually do have a resolution at this meeting at the House of Delegates, number 602. I'm just going to mention it. I can't talk about it other than just tell you that it is a resolution. They are updating their standards. I don't think any of them have anything to do with experts, though, the changes.
No.
But you have been part of that for quite some time.
Well, the first principles, Robert Gray, when he was president of the ABA, put together a committee that Trish Rifo chaired of judges and attorneys and a couple of us academics. And we wrote the 2005 principles for juries and jury trials. And 2 years ago, the chair of the jury commission, Brooks, decided that it was high time that there was a set of amendments. So we went through the entire principles, and most of them, stood the test of time. But there are some significant changes in them, and as Laura says, it's going to the House of Delegates on Monday. Those principles are, in fact, cited in court cases and used as authority in situations. And they have, I think, been a comforting thing for some state commissions deciding when they wanted to make changes in their jury system. So that's what's happening Monday.
And one of them, I think, has to do with remote technology, because clearly things have evolved so much since the pandemic and how that's used in the jury system. So stay tuned, because that should be quite interesting, I think. So anyway, I want to thank this amazing panel. Join me, please, in thanking them. And thank you for being here, and thank the ABF for funding this phenomenal research. If you're not a fellow, you should become one. I'll just plug that. It's a great organization. So thank you so much for being here.